All things move from faith to fact. The facts cannot become cannot come first, because they must result from the effects of faith upon our own conduct. So we say to ourselves, we can study the Vedas, we can study the great Buddhist scriptures, we can study the mandalas and the meditation symbols, we can read the ancient writings concerning the esoteric orders, we can do all these things. And they may give us a certain sensitivity. They may help us to prepare ourselves for the first active participation on our own part. We can say to ourselves, reading or studying these things, that they seem reasonable. And why do they seem reasonable? Because they explain values which we are all seeking, but which are not to be found in the common daily living of mankind. There seems to be a reason why virtue should triumph. There seems to be a reason why effort should be rewarded according to its kind. There seems to be a reason why somewhere in the lurking in the background of things is justice. Without some faith in these integrities, we are completely lost. And we are more or less in that condition of being completely lost now. We are very largely committed to trivia. We are also gradually infected with the idea that where there are no certainties, there is no reason for integrity. That there is no reason why we should try to be better than we are if it is all going to end in an oblivion. If there is no consciousness after death, if there is no survival of some part of the inner life of man, then all morality on the material plane is undermined. Some will answer that there is possible to be ethical without being a believer in a divine plan. This is potentially true. An individual can be honest because he believes in honesty. But the price of honesty on that basis of belief is very high. The individual who believes that he must try to be honest but has no concept of an honest universe is at a disadvantage. He will be constantly struck by the pressures of external circumstances. He will be tempted and tempted again, almost beyond his human strength to resist. He will have no strength from within himself to support what might be his ethical conviction. It is far better, therefore, to realize that ethics is a solid fact supported by the whole universe, and that the laws of ethics cannot be violated without disaster to all concerned. It is somewhere in this problem of cause and effect, of reward and punishment, of growth through effort and disintegration through neglect of effort. These are the factors that somehow must gradually come into focus. We have to believe in a life bigger than this, or we cannot live well here. We have to believe in a power greater than our own, or our own small strength will fail. Now, it doesn't seem to be very necessary to have a tremendous imagination in order to believe in values. Every day in our material way of life, we are accepting without question and without proof attitudes which we allow to take over our lives for no good reason. We are constantly believing that which is not true, simply because it is popular, because everybody thinks that way, or because it seems more profitable. But if we gain a certain satisfaction from believing that which is not true, how much greater satisfaction awaits the individual who believes that which is true. And wherever there is truth, there is improvement. Wherever there is truth, there is progress. And all truth and progress lead to peace and the integration of the human personality. Now then, coming to our present world affairs, we have a great many people today who are looking for spiritual strength. They are looking for help in their problems and in their concerns. And many of them are beginning to think in terms of hierarchy, in thinking in terms of the strengthening power of a more constructive belief. Now, when this comes along, we always also have the doubting Thomas. We have the individual who will believe that he can put his finger in the wound. But in this particular case, we are again at a disadvantage. The average person is not in a position to weigh, estimate, and validate various beliefs and doctrines that are gradually gaining circulation. The individual does not know how to determine what constitutes the true expression of hierarchy, and that which in one way or another is itself a fantasy. We do not know, or do not have the skill for the most part, of determining the qualities of the values which are communicated to us in the terms of an esoteric tradition. We are not able to tell for certain what is the source of a certain idea or a certain doctrine, or the validity of a certain organization, or the integrity of a basic conviction about life that may arise in our environment. How can we evaluate these things? How can we avoid delusion and illusion? How can we be sure that the particular belief that we have is founded in enlightenment, in true esotericism, or perhaps, like too many exploiting problems of today, it has gradually been dominated by an exploitation concept? In other words, are we going to find the true thing that we seek, or are we going to be imposed upon again? This is always a grave question. The ancients faced it, and those today who believe in esoteric things will have to face it again. The answer lies, of course, in one thing: integrities. The individual will have to use his own faculties to determine the validity and integrity of the things he believes. He is going to have to judge his own conduct. He is going to have to consider his own relationship with life. Why is he seeking is the first problem. Why is he trying to know more than he knows now? Why does he want to get in contact with these mysterious invisibles? Well, there's a big question. Most people who believe that they want this contact believe they are looking for it in a sincere and admirable manner. But in a great many instances, even an ordinary family psychologist can point to their shortcomings. Most people looking for more enlightenment cannot escape from the concept of self-advancement. I know people come frequently for advice. Some want to be enlightened because they're sick and they want to get well. Some want to be enlightened because of family problems. Some want to be enlightened because of their romantic interests. Some wish to get further financial support. Others wish to escape the hatreds and unpleasantness that have burdened them all their lives. Some want to escape from the world. They want to find in philosophy an illumined form of death, a transition into another sphere where they will be no longer burdened with the problems that are here. Many different motives are found. And most of the time, the people you discuss these matters with have to restate their own motives before a discussion is over. They start in by saying that they want this, or they want that, or they believe this, and then after a little discussion they begin to amend their own previous statements, because it gradually dawns upon them that their statement of motive is not right. The search for truth depends almost completely upon the problem of motive. The motive is the all-important thing. And motive, to most people, like most theological problems, is consolation. They want to rest in peace in a world in confusion. They wish to have the kind of insight which will enable them to face the problems of the outer life more successfully. They do not recognize that there is a motive higher than this, and that the esoteric system is all based upon the ultimate motive. And that ultimate motive is the service of truth itself, a complete dedication to the service of the realities of existence. It is only through this type of dedication that there is any possibility, as the Neoplatonists pointed out, of that mysterious inward moment in which the individual, without any real intention or without any real desire for it, is suddenly in the presence of the reality, simply because he has come to deserve it. And the moment it is deserved, it is there. And according to the Hermetic tradition of the adept doctrine, when the disciple is ready, the teacher appears. Now, this was part of the alchemical theory. The old alchemists worked a lifetime in their laboratories with their bottles and their chemicals and their retorts and their furnaces. And they worked and they struggled and they tried and they gave everything they had to it. And then one night, for no reason whatever, sometime along the line, the mysterious stranger appears. He was supposed, of course, always to be a projection or a manifestation of the supreme artist of all, Elias Artista. And he would come into the laboratory without giving his name. He came in sometimes through the walls without opening a door. He said a few words to the alchemist, gave him the answer to his question, and then disappeared and was never seen again by that alchemist. But the whole theory behind, of course, the whole theory, is that alchemy was the science of regeneration. If the disciple is dedicated to self-discipline, the correction of personal weaknesses, the gradual improvement of his own life, and never for a moment compromises this improvement, he may in due time have that moment's visit from Elias Artista, the one who will give him the answer. Now, in the actual life of the human being, we have to realize, as was true of St. Francis of Assisi, Raymond Lully, many others, that the human being is not perfect, is not going to easily become perfect. Furthermore, that the experiences of imperfection are very important. The individual who has never made a mistake has seldom ever done anything well, because it is necessary to grow through mistakes, grow through doing things that perhaps are repented. We all do these things in spite of our good intentions. But as we become more and more dedicated to the realities, we begin to reinterpret our own mistakes. We find that these mistakes become partial, at least, proof of the very truth we are seeking. We begin to realize how we did it not so well, and begin to realize how we can do it better. Little by little, the past with its mistakes is transmuted, like the base metals of alchemy, into a realization of the disciplines that are necessary to our own growth. So today, with these various organizations that appear, I have not, in writing, ever discussed the merits or demerits of contemporary organizations. I don't want to do this, because it can only lead to endless difficulty, inasmuch as evidences that are acceptable are difficult to find, and it becomes a battle of convictions in which people are hurt, people are discouraged, and it all ends in nothing. There is no way of solving it this way. Rather, instead of that, I'd like to put the emphasis where it seems to me that it really belongs. That the only way that the individual can surely and truly attain the contact with the Hermetic mystery, as it is described by Mrs. Atwood in her work on alchemy, the Hermetic mystery is something that is discovered through the transmutation of self. It is something that arises from gradual control of the factors of life. No one is going to contact these esoteric systems by desperation. They are not going to get there by a verbal dedication. They are not going to get there by a contribution, no matter how generous it is. They cannot. The answer is they have to reach it through the gradual development of the faculties within themselves, by means of which they are able to attain contact with these esoteric schools. One Oriental system pointed out very clearly that the magnetic field of the human body is like the furnace of the alchemist. This magnetic field is varicolored, and its hues are continuously changing. And every major trend in the disposition results in a major change in the colors, tones, and qualities of the light emanating from the human body. Therefore, thought forms become very important, and the radiance coming from these thought forms are believed to be the basis of the recognition of the spiritual development of an individual. If these radiances are sufficiently powerful and sufficiently clear, then anyone who knows can interpret them. And if there is a light by which the individual can be seen by some esoteric institution, it is through these radiances changing within his own constitution. These things cannot be faked. The radiance cannot be hidden, nor can any mistaken interpretation modify its coloration or its intensity. Everything that has to do with the divine chemistry in man has to be completely honest. And every effect of this type of regeneration is completely evident in the life of the person and in the development of the magnetic field. So we start by assuming what we have to assume, that the individual has to earn the right to these things. Truth must be earned. It must be earned by the individual realizing that he is, in a sense, in exile. He is in a condition natural and proper to the lack of perfection of his own vehicles. Evolution has been a constant description and revelation of the unfoldment of instruments. The body unfolds. The faculties become stronger. The propensities are intensified. Evolution produces higher and higher species, like the chambered story of the Nautilus, in which the Nautilus is always building more beautiful mansions for its soul. But the individual must also build these mansions for his soul. There must be this constant improvement of the inner life, and the effort to conceal the weakness of the internal by strengthening the external is a dismal failure. I would suggest then that those who are really sincere look very carefully at what they become involved in order that they may not make a mistake which they will regret. On the other hand, if they do make a mistake, they should not be in despair, because the mistake is not primarily the fact that they have been deceived. The real fact is the mistake is because they have deceived themselves. The individual cannot be deceived if his own integrities cannot be tempted, or he cannot be lured away from the facts of life into some false doctrine which cannot produce the goals which he seeks. No doctrine can grow for another person. No individual can grow because of another person helping him to grow. The other person may give him certain instruction, may inspire him, but every action of life that is a growth must be motivated by the person who is seeking to grow. His friends, his teachers, all those around him can help, but no one can grow for someone else any more than one person can digest food for another. It is absolutely necessary that growth be the result of personal improvement. Now, in Christendom, we also have another interesting parallel to the adept tradition, and that is the story of the saints. The Western world has gradually substituted the saint concept for the ancient arhats and rishis of the East. The saints become again intercessors between man and divinity. These saints are miniature saviors. They possess something of the power of the sacrifice they have made for the good of the world. And from this sacrifice, a certain sanctity has been bestowed upon themselves. The saint, therefore, is in a sense another example of the esoteric tradition, the hierarchy. The saints become an order of intermediaries between deity and mankind. If this has any foundation in validity, and it is held as sacred by hundreds of millions of people, it is because of this very fact that the individual who loses his life or gives his life for a principle greater than himself shall have life everlasting. The saint is most commonly canonized because of martyrdom. And this martyrdom is the giving of all of self, unselfishly, to the glory of God on the service of each other. This constitutes, then, what to the ancient esoteric orders would be the qualification necessary for participation in the esoteric circle of illumines. The saint becomes the symbol of the person who has achieved the complete renunciation of himself in the service of others, that he becomes capable, therefore, of interceding and becomes an intercessor, as all the world teachers have been, by means of which the eternal power of things is refreshed and restored in confidence by the proof that among its creatures there are those who are moving definitely and dedicatedly toward union with itself. Therefore, those who become dedicated have certain virtues, certain powers, and certain authorities vested in them. And this concept leads, of course, to the concept, finally, that these together become the interpreters of the law. They are interpreters not on our level, but on the level of absolute unselfishness, absolute impersonality, absolute obedience. These things are a little hard for Western man to accept. We have gradually become more and more convinced of our own importance. We have more or less felt that some way we were going to change the world. But the more effort we put in that direction, the more we endanger the world. Because that which attempts to solve problems by force, by strength, by wealth, by authority, all of these conditions are ultimately failures. There were times in the early history of mankind when there were shepherd kings guarding the destiny of mortals, where, according to Homer and others of the ancient world, the gods walked with men. They descended as teachers and guardians and guides, and they spoke through the prophets of old, as we find in the Old Testament. But gradually something else happened. As the individual grows up, he is no longer dependent upon elders entirely. He cannot be trained by being forced to perform certain virtuous actions. He cannot be made honest by being whipped if he is dishonest. He cannot become virtuous because he is punished as a criminal. The individual must make these changes of himself, in himself, and by himself. He must gradually build up these values which he knows to be right. Gradually, therefore, the shepherd kings vanished from the world, and the individual became a self-reliant individual, possessing what St. Thomas Aquinas called a limited determinism, the right to choose to do right. And this choice to do right, voluntarily met, the individual actually choosing to supply his inner life with greater integrities, has made an important personal step. It is very much more important to make one small step in one's own way than to be pushed into something that appears to be much greater. So that in the gradual evolution of the great mystery school, which is the world, the individual has had to make decisions, and these decisions are the basis of his spiritual development and the maturity of his soul. He must choose these things in the presence of temptation. He must recognize that when it appears most likely that he might succeed materially, it is also possible that he might fail in the great purposes of life. Consequently, there must be always this continuous stress upon personal integrities, personal dedications, and personal purifications. We honor most the great teachers of our race. We honor those who have sacrificed life and time and have also brought us the deepest and most wonderful revelations that the world has ever received. We respect these people. We honor them. We build temples, churches, synagogues, and mosques in their honor. We create priesthoods to serve them. We support their material needs with generous contributions. We respect them in every way, and yet for some strange reason, we cannot live according to the teachings that they give us. We continue to make the common mistakes that our ancestors made 10,000 years ago. We still cannot escape the power of ego, the power of self-will coming into conflict with divine will. Therefore, if we really want to understand the esoteric tradition and hope that sometime we might be worthy to have direct contact with it through reputable and proper instruments, we have to carefully explore all of the teachings that are now circulated under those terms. We have to look at the revelations attributed to prophets and teachers to make sure that those revelations are a challenge to our integrities and not a justification of our weaknesses. We have to be sure that we are going to be disciplined, not that we are going to be relieved of discipline. That we are going to have to live better, not finding ways to gain the ends we want without the corrections of our own faults. No amount of believing will protect us if we do not live according to the beliefs that we hold. And a great believing is sometimes too much for us. We have an idea of some very great, wonderful thing that might happen, and in the presence of it, we are unable to face the small problems of the day. Beliefs should be simple. They should be within our comprehension. And as our comprehension increases, our believing will be enriched. But it must begin with simple and gentle convictions. If we can work with these problems, we will then probably find, as we have in the past, that there will be powerful restorations of esoteric knowledge. There will be reformations in our system of schooling. Little by little, these changes are taking place now. Opinions that 20 years ago were considered heresy from a scientific standpoint are now regarded with considerable interest and attention. Little by little, the secret way of life is coming through. It is coming through because we are in desperate need of it. It also is coming through because all physical or mortal knowledge leads finally in the direction of metaphysical and immortal knowledge. It is only that we have to allow it to unfold. If, however, we lock our material knowledge in prejudiced attitudes, if we continue to bind our spirits and our souls to the millstone of the Philistines, then these other things simply cannot happen. But each person has one other consolation to bear in mind, namely that if the integrity is what it ought to be, no condition of society can stand between the individual and the enlightenment that he deserves. No amount of corruption can destroy the just person. No amount of pressure, circumstance, or tragedy can take away the integrity of the person who is really dedicated to the principles of truth and light. He can go on. He does not have to be supported by his society, or his family, or his friends, or his nation, or his world. It is his privilege to live his beliefs. It is his privilege to continue to grow, because actually, his growth is not a public event. This is where trouble gets in. When we try to proclaim our growth, it is questioned. But if quietly we grow so that people do not question our growth because they see it, then we are in a much more secure position. No one can stop us. Even the greatest tyrant cannot prevent us from growing. If our growth is turned toward our inner life and not in conflict with outer circumstances, the individual, by releasing themselves from the worldliness in themselves, transcend the power of worldly authority to destroy them. They keep on growing in their own proper and natural way. So we really recommend that most people begin to think seriously about the invisible government of the world, that it is our only hope, that we know perfectly well that our own politicians are not going to get us there. We know definitely that unless there is an integrity in space, there is little hope for us. But if there is an integrity in space, then integrity is indestructible. We will achieve that which we deserve. And the universe has this vast mechanism, referred to as hierarchy, to make sure that the just person is given the enlightenment that he deserves, and to make sure that all injustice is finally corrected, and that in the end we shall live to become part of the universal plan, and not in a desperate effort to create some type of an economic empire in the material world. We have to live in this world, but we have to render unto Caesar the things that are Caesar's. But we also have to render unto God the things that are His. And our eternal destiny, our souls, our hearts, our minds, our labors, in our integrities, all are the things that we must render unto God. Because deity is the source of all good in ourselves. And that good we must bring as an offering to the world, to our neighbor, to the divine power which fashioned it. So in this type of thinking, we can perhaps gain some, support from the realization that out there somewhere is a plan that will not fail, and that it has been served for countless ages by dedicated beings of this world or of some other, who have transcended all human limitations and have outgrown all human ambitions and desires, and live only that the will of heaven be done. And they become the instruments of that will. And as we become, even in a small way, little instruments in that will and of that will, we too begin to share in its eternity. And in our own lives, we have a growth that will give us peace of soul, even under the pressure of present world conditions. And at this season of the resurrection, it is particularly fitting that we bear these thoughts in mind, that they world has not been left without hope, that man has not been left without the key to unlock his own destiny, but the individual must use the integrities he has to perfect those integrities which must yet be developed within his own nature. When he is capable of doing this, he will fulfill the law and will live for the glory of God and the well-being of all creatures that exist. This is a proper thought, it seems to me, for this particular season of the year. Well, folks, that's that for this morning. And I'd like to make an announcement or two. At this season of the year, I nearly always announce something that my wife is working on. And the program for the development of the Bruton Vault, the opening of Bruton Vault, Williamsburg, this program is gaining considerable momentum. And more and more people are becoming concerned with it. And we hope that if you do not have a copy of her little book, Foundations on Earth, that you will secure a copy, because there is really quite a lot of activity after many years, probably because the time has come when the average person is more and more concerned with the protection of the entire world and less concerned with the success of his own small enterprises. And on the same basis, she has another publication which I think you would enjoy, and that is World and Family Enlightenment. We were out last evening to see a very lovely family that has a new 6-month-old baby daughter. These people are really very fine people, and their efforts to be right in this world, to do what is right, it should not only be respected, but it should be strengthened by information, by a broader understanding of life and what relationships are. And my wife, in her little publication, World and Family Relations, gives a picture of a family of worlds, a family of nations, a family of people, which I think you will enjoy and may help you to make this Easter significant. We thank you for being with us, and we hope to see you in the near future.